The Keepers. The Netflix documentary on the mystery surrounding the death of Sister Kathy Sesnick dropped today, putting that old Baltimore story squarely back in the spotlight.
Jamie, the documentary focuses much of the attention on the death of Sister Catherine Sesnick and the allegations swirling around Father Joseph Maskell. What was a Baltimore story may soon be a worldwide one.
Shocking revelations in the 1969 murder of a Baltimore nun. Two women close to the case are telling WJZ they know who killed Sister Kathy Sesnick. What's more, they believe her death may be linked to widespread sexual abuse by a powerful priest that took place decades ago.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is your host, Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor and retired FBI profiler and currently writer and producer on CBS's Criminal Minds Season 13. And with me today is...
From London, Laura Richards, former New Scotland Yard criminal behavioral analyst, advocate, analyst, author, and director and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I am Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague.
Well, Laura, congratulations on all the great things that are happening with Paladin in the UK.
Thank you so much, Jim C. It's certainly been a whirlwind since I've been back. And not only were we in the media with one of our cases, Helen Pearson, who was stalked for 5 years and suffered 125 behaviors and reported them to police, and then she was almost killed. And we went to talk to the media about her experience and how the police let her down. But it was also our fourth birthday as well. So it's been a really busy period. And the release of the report into the police by Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary, who also inspected the Crown Prosecution Service, also showed how victims were really being let down 4 years on from us changing the law on stalking.
Well, that's great. And congratulations. And I saw you had tea in the House of Lords, right?
Tea on the terrace at the House of Lords, which was fantastic. That was, I wanted to take my team there with Baroness Jam Royal, who's incredibly generous. And we wanted to celebrate our 4 years in existence and helping over 2,000 victims. So we are the only national service and the only trauma-informed service in the world, as you know. And with all that media increase in our profile, the phone's been ringing constantly and lots of people have been reaching out to us for help.
Yeah, and Zoe Dronefield was at that tea as well. She's in the picture. And if you haven't heard her episode, please look it up in our back catalog because she has a really important story to tell. And come to our Facebook page and you can also sign a petition that Laura has going around about a stalker and domestic abuse registry.
Just to say, it's episode 36
that you
can find on our feed, which is featuring Zoe Dronefield. And she was victim number 13. He was a very predatory individual. And this is something that we feel very strongly about, that we want to see a register for serial stalkers and domestic violence offenders. So please do sign the petition. As Lisa said, it's on Facebook and it's also on our Twitter feed.
Well, today we're going to start a series of podcasts about a very compelling and, I might add, disturbing documentary series called The Keepers. You can find it on Netflix and it is very well done, very well shot. But the topic, I just have to give a warning right now. I never cursed so much at that TV ever before. But when I heard some of the things that were said, some of the things that the players in this series of cases have said, particularly the assistant district attorney.
Oh yeah,
May.
I want to talk to you about her.
Yeah. I've just never cursed so much at a TV before. And I have to tell you in advance, if you have sensitive ears, you might hear me raise my voice a little bit and get a little mad during this podcast.
Yeah, we have a listener who wrote to me, Lisa, do you really have to swear so much? And I've really been trying to be good, but fuck that, man. This is, if any case deserved outrage,
this one is.
And I'm sorry, I'm just going to have to...
Well, it's emblematic of... thousands, and when I say thousands, I mean thousands of separate cases, separate instances where Catholic priests have violated children sexually and been moved from church to church to church and had the ability to do it over and over and over again. And that's just part of the issues that are raised in The Keepers. There's also the murder.
Yeah. So, yeah, we should probably...
Well, two murders. And I think we should discuss those together,
right?
Because I agree, this is very angry-making when you watch it. And it's very hard not to, feel that so much has gone on in such a long period of time. And, of course, this is a 7-part Netflix documentary. And it started really looking at the murders. But the documentary maker, Ryan White, basically said that he discovered during the filmmaking process... It was like, peeling an onion. Mm-hmm. There were just so many layers to it and you kept peeling them back and it just got deeper and deeper. That's the analogy I normally use, like peeling an onion. I think there's so much for us to discuss here. And I'm just going to throw my hat in the ring here. I went to a convent school, my first school, when I was 4 years of age. And I have to say, even though I was little, I still have memories that stayed with me. More so, I had one really nice nun who I was one of the youngest in the school, Sister Christina, who was really lovely. But if you talk to my older sister about this experience at this convent school called St. Martha's, she would tell you that every Monday she had this teacher called Sister Mary Raffaelli, and she would cry and cry and cry and would not let my mum put her in the car because she was just so strict and mean and horrible and nasty. And I've got to say, they are my memories about that school, of just how nasty the nuns there were. They were cruel and wicked without reason.
I can relate to what your sister said. And I went through Catholic school all the way through law school. So I went for first grade to eighth grade, ninth grade to 12th grade. 4 years of college and 4 years of law school, all to different Catholic schools. Now, I will say that my experience changed, but certainly in first grade, I was writing with my left hand because I'm left-handed. And I was told by the nuns that I was writing with the hand of the devil. And they would come by my desk when I was doing penmanship, and they would hit me with a ruler on my left hand and force me to write with my right hand. Every time I went home, I would write my penmanship out with my left hand and do very well. And then when I was taking my tests and doing my work at school, I would fail because they made me do it with my right hand. They made me stand in the corner. It made me feel like I was horrible. I was writing with the hand of the devil. I mean, what a horrible thing to do to a child.
Yeah,
I agree. I mean, I'd love to say, are you serious? I just can't believe that happened. But, at the age of 4, not wanting to eat a dessert, they sat me in a parlor. And then when I was sick, I got tapped on the bum, so to speak, and made to feel like I was devil worshipping or doing something. And my mother came to pick me up and I was in tears. But I can tell you, every Monday, my sister would feign a stomachache to the point that, she would always be crying. Mm. And when she had a real appendicitis, my mother didn't believe her because, these histrionics were something that we kind of got used to in our household. So I was really relieved when I didn't go there. We left that school after a year, and my mum said the same, that, these nuns were just wicked for the sake of being wicked. Now, I'm sure there are people out there who've had other experiences, but certainly when I was watching this, certain things did resonate. And I think that it's an interesting thing when you have religion sort of being or something, a belief system that people can hide behind and on the one hand look holier than thou, but they're not being kind or compassionate or nice or thoughtful, and show certainly, no compassion or empathy, I think, and, allows them to hide in plain sight, really.
Yeah, and I know we're going to get into the documentary and how it lays out this whole story, but I just want to say my noni, when she would always tell me when she was in this tiny little village in northern Italy, she was very afraid of the nuns. And like you say, Laura, when she was 4 years old, a nun stood in front of her and she was so terrified that she peed on the nun's shoe. Just out of terror. And the nun made her take off. And the nun made her take off her little underwear and walk home naked from the waist down, holding her wet underwear all the way home. So, I mean, it's just so sad to think of that young age. Now, we're going to talk all about the Catholic Church and everything. But, when the story of the Keepers unfolds, what we're talking about is kind of, we don't get to that for a while.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But the point is that this is a situation in which the church, and particularly when they ran schools, had a tremendous impact on the students' lives. And we have all shared experiences from our lives and from our families just now. And this is an important context to keep in mind when you're thinking about what these victims recount and why they didn't come forward at the time.
But
such an important context, Jim, as you said, and quite right to put it in that context.
Yes.
However, we start with the victimology in this case. And the Keepers starts out as an investigation of a cold case homicide. Sister Catherine Sesnick. She was born in 1942, and she died in 1969. What is overwhelmingly clear from what everybody says about her, both students and colleagues and friends, they all said that she exemplified the spirit of kindness and compassion. And one person even said she actually had so much compassion, she had compassion for the earth. And I think that statement kind of sums up how everybody described Sister Catherine. And I think that the way she impacted the students of that school, the way she impacted everybody she came in touch with, really tells us what kind of person she was.
Right. She was very, very not like the nun image that we've come to understand. I mean, she played music, she was outgoing, she was friendly. The students felt like they could talk to her. She taught at Kehoe for 4 years. And in that really short time, I mean, she was just a beloved drama and English teacher who encouraged the girls to express themselves and write and read poetry. Go on, Laura, did I interrupt you?
And just to put that in context also, she started teaching there when she was 23. And she died when she was 27.
So just so you know,
which is very, very sad. And when you put it in the context of her life, lots of energy, young, approachable. There were lots of people who said she was the favorite teacher. They could talk to her about anything, that she soothed their soul. And she was a standout beauty. I mean, you can see beauty on the inside and on the outside, and that she was a bubbly personality. And some people compared her to Julie Andrews, you know, from The Sound of Music. Because she was such a beauty and bubbly personality. So this is in stark contrast when she just suddenly disappears and she vanishes.
And at one point they even play her voice. I don't know if you remember that, reading a poem. And her voice is just this light, lovely, articulated.
She sounded like a child to me.
Yeah?
She sounded so young.
She sounded like Snow White or something.
I think she was very young. I mean, I definitely would have been interested to hear from her family, actually, in the first episode, talking about her. And I think that's the thing for me that's missing right up front, that I would have liked to have heard from them describing their, you know, their daughter and their loved one, and hearing just a bit about her sort of decision making about why she decided to become a nun. Because that's a, you know, a big decision for her to take at such a young age.
Well, I think that is a fair point that you bring up, Laura, that this filmmaker definitely lays out this story in a very precise way. And we'll get into later actually who he met first when he started doing this documentary, because it may surprise you. But yeah, he introduces layer by layer, and you don't learn until much, much later in the documentary that she was actually leaving Kehoe after 4 years to teach in a public school where she wouldn't be in her habit anymore and was going to be leaving the confines of the convent to live in an apartment, which was, you know, a very radical thing to do. But she felt like she needed to be closer to, you know, real people. And her parents did remark that, you know, you've never had to pay bills. You don't. How are you going to make it in this world out there from the regimen of the convent? But
right.
That's something that she did.
Yeah, she did. She was involved in this program, and she was teaching in a public school out of the habit. Which, as you said, was kind of revolutionary. But there may have been other darker reasons why she left.
Right.
And I think we'll explore that as we get on in this documentary series.
I quite like the opening part where you're not really sure what you're going to hear or find out. But I like this character, Tom Nugent, who takes you into his loft space, and you start to, you know, get a sense of all these articles that he's written, and just sort of the disorganized element of, you know, spending time head deep into researching something, writing the article, and then he collects all of his articles, puts them upstairs. And so he's taking us through everything in the loft, which I thought was a great opener.
He's like, he's almost like the Greek chorus in the beginning. He has some great lines. You know, he's this scraggly browed, you know, beaten up guy. And it's all about who killed Sister Kathy, what lies beneath. We all go on day after day, and the boil continues to swell. And the clues to what it was linger in places like this attic, and they twist you and turn you in the wind. What is the past, and what was it? So it's just a fantastic, almost, you know, Shakespearean prologue to the whole documentary.
I think his need to try to resolve this after all these years, the fact that he wrote a massive piece in the paper about this when it did just happen, and then didn't hear anything from 1969 to 1994 about the case. I mean, it's ridiculous that something so drastic, something so out of place in this community just went unsolved, unresolved for all those years. And particularly because 4 days later, another young lady from the same neighborhood was also abducted and murdered. And that has a lot of similarities. Those two cases have a great number of similarities. So
they really do. I mean, her name was Joyce Malecki. And, you know, for such a place to have two cases like this, I mean, one being a nun, Sister Kathy, going missing, you know, is standout in and of itself when set against the backdrop, as we described, who she was and on the surface what was going on in her life. But obviously there was a lot more going on behind the scenes. But then to have another female, again, very attractive. You know, I would say these are standout, you know, females, attractive, being in their cars, going shopping, their cars being found, unlocked, and them just being disappeared. You know, this would have been national, if not international news. But, I mean, there's something also about this area, isn't there? Baltimore, which I think is interesting. And I'd like you to say something about that, Jim. I remember when I was at the FBI at Quantico and looking at different the volume of violence in different places across America. And obviously Baltimore was a real standout place. But to have victims like this, the victimology is significant and striking in and of itself.
Well, a couple of things about Baltimore. One, it's a very Catholic city. It does have a archbishop there, and it is the Catholic religion is very ingrained in that city. There are plenty of roots there. Many, many churches and many people who follow the Catholic faith in that town. However, there's also a history of violence in that town. But given that, the violence is not typically against nuns and single white females. That is not the typical victimology for crimes in this town of this nature. So these two crimes, so close together, stood out from the rest by far. And it's not just because they're white women. It's because of their low-risk lifestyle. They weren't engaging in any behavior that should have put them at risk. And yet, they both, within a space of 4 days, go missing and are brutally murdered.
Sister Kathy exemplified this spirit of compassion and kindness.
I have never had a teacher like that before.
She was murdered our senior year, and it's always haunted many people in the community.
Our mission, we were driven to find out who hurt Sister Kathy.
I'm just going to say that Joyce's brothers commented that they really felt safe in their town, that nobody locked the doors. So maybe this was a different part of Baltimore County that didn't see the kind of violence that we've come to know, like on The Wire and other.
Certainly The Wire depicts a time during and after the 80s when there was a crack epidemic which decimated many inner city areas like Baltimore. And I believe that crime just skyrocketed there and in most other major cities at that time. But back in the late 60s, it wasn't anywhere near as violent, and there wasn't anywhere near the kind of drug culture that had grown 20 years later.
I thought it was also interesting that, you know, it being the 45-year-old cold case, there was a line just in the documentary where he said, well, you know, I believe that the crime is not the murder, but the cover-up. I actually disagree with that, because I think the murders are really standout murders here. And I want us to make sure, you know, Real Crime Profile is about giving the voice to the victim. And it does feel in many senses, yes, there was a focus to some degree on Kathy, but Joyce Malecki seems to have been lost as this beautiful young woman who just disappeared and went missing. And there's no resolution or no real answers or any real focus really in terms of sort of the crime scene, what happened, her victimology. So I think it would be an important thing for us to say something about those two cases together. And then obviously, you know, looking at peeling away of what was going on behind the scenes in terms of the cover up itself.
Yeah, it's astonishing that her family, Joyce's family, have been banging on the door of authorities trying to get some kind of information. And they just are met with silence. I mean, that was shocking to me, Jim. And they don't have nice things to say about the FBI. I don't know if you can address why it would take so long for them to get any information at all.
Well, I think typically the FBI, when they're doing an investigation, they don't give out information. Mm. Certainly the victim's families deserve to have some information if there is information that can be shared. But you have to understand, I mean, in many investigations, the place where it starts is the family. And I don't know if they made assumptions about the family early on. I don't know if there were things going on, but it doesn't appear to be an issue at all with the family. And I believe that as a cold case, what probably happened was they came to the FBI to ask them information, and there was no active investigation going on, and to sort of avoid embarrassment about that, they just said, it's an active investigation, we can't tell you anything, and turned them away. It's just a horrible thing to treat families in that way. There should be a family liaison who can at least share whatever information is public, and certainly give them the consolation of knowing that the FBI is working for them and wants to actually resolve the case.
I think certainly what stayed with me was her brother describing having to identify her. Mm. You know, and this is the stuff that in, you know, movies and the like, Hollywood, with murder becoming entertainment, you know, this is the reality of what confronts not just law enforcement or people who find, you know, the hunters who found her, but obviously the families when they have to identify their loved one, and him just saying that that's the final image that will stay with him forever. And of course it will be burned onto his retina. And he describes that very vividly, and that she was found face down, and of course she'd been in a stream, and her hands had been tied behind her back, which I thought was interesting, Jim. Her throat had been cut, and her face was dirty, had hair sticks in it, and her brother said how haunted he was. But the throat being cut, to me, tends to be a silencing someone forever, and as we know, it's up close and personal. You know, and her being found in a remote and isolated area.
Yeah, down.
Do you want to say something about that?
Yes, that is also a similarity in the body disposition location for Sister Kathy, because her body was found sort of in a rural area, down a dirt road, in a dump site kind of area. And unfortunately, her body was also found in a small stream called the Little Patuxent River. I think that the fact that there was so much violence, the throat slashing, the arms tied behind the back, the fact that she was brutalized tells me that this person had a lot of rage. And if we can talk a little bit about Sister Kathy's body when it was recovered, because her body was recovered 2 months after she went missing, the fact that it was the wintertime meant that it was fairly well preserved. And I know that they talked about the fact that she was recovered at the scene laying on her back, that her clothes were stripped down to her waist. She wasn't shot or stabbed, and her body had not deteriorated. There is a big issue. The detective who was the first on the scene, he was Lieutenant James Scannell, and he said that there was no maggots or anything like that because of the time of year. Later, that will become an issue.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about it when we get to that. And it's a very important issue. And then our own Dr. Werner Spitz will weigh in on that very same issue and clarify things.
But I think where she was found is a significant place. I mean, she was found 2 months later, but Joyce Malecki was found the day afterwards in the remote woods. But Sister Kathy being found on a rubbish site, a dump site, you know, the notion of putting out the trash, putting out the rubbish, struck me as significant there as well.
Right. Well, she suffered blunt force trauma to one side of her head, along with a blow that left a round hole in the back of her skull. So there's a lot of violence also in this case. And so if we were to consider these cases together to determine whether or not they were committed by the same offender, I would look at the fact that there was a lot of violence in both cases, that obviously there was disrespect in how they were just tossed aside, discarded, that perhaps, for example, if Sister Kathy was killed by someone she knows, and I'll get into a little bit about that and the car and so forth, about why I believe that was the case, but if Sister Kathy was killed by someone she knows, and then that same person felt emboldened by the fact that he had gotten away with this, basically, and he actually liked it, he may have then taken an opportunity to abduct and kill Joyce just 4 days later, because that case indicates that he didn't know her, that he had to basically control her with ligatures, binding her arms, and that he took her to a place and she was found very quickly only because there were hunters out that day. Had there not been hunters out that day, it may have been months as well when she was found. So I think that those are similarities, and I think there is a behavioral sort of escalation between those two cases, but there are a lot of similarities. What do you think, Laura?
Well, the similarities are striking if we think about geography, just on that alone. I don't know the rate of how many other women were, you know, across a time period, let's say 5 years, were found in similar circumstances, you know, stranger-related potential crimes like this, as in not the domestic violence cases of domestic homicide. But I think, you know, Sister Kathy, obviously it's like peeling an onion. There's lots of things that were going on in the background there as to why she just suddenly disappears, having gone shopping of an evening. And then we obviously, as you know, Jim, you know, the sequence of events is really important to know what was happening, you know, the night, the day before, the next day. She just goes shopping. No, some of her friends knew that she was going shopping for an engagement present, and it looks like she never returned to her apartment. But the car is definitely an interesting point of where the car was found. So I think that is a striking aspect here. And obviously Joyce's car was found too. But I did wonder, you know, if we take it on the victimology in terms of what they look like and, you know, on the face of it, how they present, that they were lone females going to shopping centres, that they were both in their cars, that there was extreme, you know, violence. I don't mean overkill, but I mean actually other things could have been done differently, slitting someone's or slashing someone's throat or cutting their throat, and the blunt force trauma to Sister Kathy's head. I think there were two strikes, and the way the bodies were found, the geography of it. But I did wonder about Joyce Malecki, you know, whether there was any timeline for her. Was she in the same shopping area as where Kathy was? Was she seen at a similar time? Did she perhaps see something which made her then become a target? So these were some of the hypotheses I was sort of working through. Or, of course, there is a hypothesis that perhaps whoever it was who may have had a different motive for doing what he did to Sister Kathy, maybe there was some enjoyment there and it was an escalation. But I think we do have to consider the fact that given that Kathy was out and about and people did see her, this potential killer is taking some big risks here, not just in terms of abducting her, but also in terms of where they dispose of her body, but then in terms of the car.
Yeah.
And at any of those points or junctures, could they be witnessed by somebody? Now, was it that Joyce Malecki did see something and that led her to then become a target? But yeah, let's return to the cars, because I think that's very interesting that, you know, whoever killed Sister Kathy, the car was then parked near her home address, wasn't it? Illegally parked, and for all to see. So it would have taken some time and energy and commitment to abduct her, to kill her, but obviously to return the car and to place it in such a peculiar standout place.
Well, I think it's very clear from that one piece of evidence that the killer originated from that apartment complex. In other words, that the killer met Sister Kathy at that apartment complex, left his car there, got into her vehicle, drove her out to the isolated area where her body was then found, killed her either in the car or outside in that area, and then returned the car to the parking lot, or the street right around the corner from her apartment in a hurry, left the keys in the ignition, the door open. There was mud and sticks hanging from the inside and outside of the vehicle. Clearly it had been driven into a rural area, a secluded, muddy area, but must have gone back there with the car in order to retrieve his own vehicle, because there's no other reason and there's no other way logistically, unless there were multiple offenders, for that to have happened. But the fact that it was left there in a haphazard manner means that it was done very quickly. And so I think the offender looked for an opportunity, because the alarm had probably been raised by the time the offender brought the car back. And so they parked it right around the corner and then ran back to their car and removed it from the location. Of course, what should have happened immediately is somebody should have called the police, and the police should have locked down that whole area so that anybody trying to come in and out would be stopped and identified. You might have caught the killer's car right there in the parking lot, because I believe he was probably parked close to that area, because that's why the car was left there. In terms of Joyce Malecki's car, it was left outside of a Fast Mart kind of place, parked in around the side of the building, in the parking area, with the keys in the ignition and unlocked. Again, that seems like a deliberate attempt to get in and get out very quickly. They didn't spend the time to make it look like she had run away somewhere, leaving it, say, at a bus station or something that would indicate there was some level of planning around trying to sort of forensically throw off the police investigation. No, her car was left in a place where it was very likely to be found very quickly with the keys in the ignition, similar to the situation with Sister Kathy's.
I think what you were saying, Jim, about her being taken from outside her property probably does make sense because of the cars, as you describe, but also there were two other girls who were in the same neighborhood who went to look on one of their stalking one of their teachers. I mean, that felt uncomfortable. Young girls with crushes, you know, and hanging out and going using the phone book to find their teachers. But I think that what they heard was significant. And, you know, if we believe their account, which is one of them saying that she heard screaming, and it was a man's voice, first of all, but it was anger and it sounded like violence, and it was coming from near where Kathy's apartment was. And that's what made them leave. And of course, you know, it makes sense. They hear this scream, they hear a man's voice. That's probably when the first blow comes to pass, where she is hit on the head, put into the car, and probably more then follows. But that succession, or that sequence of events of them dealing with her and obviously the transfer that's on the car, and having to come back to pick up your own car and leaving in a hurry because not wanting to spend time there or not knowing exactly where the car should be, but having to get out of there in as quick as time possible. You know, if we think about Occam's razor, the principle of the most basic and simplest explanation normally being the right one, that was, you know, in my mind's eye, thinking this through, that would make sense. So it means that somebody who has been to her apartment or knew where her apartment was, you know, had been there before and engaged her. So her shopping trip probably was completed, and she was met at the point where she's either gone back into the apartment or they knock on the door and she's abducted from there.
The director of The Keepers, Ryan White, has an aunt who attended Keough at the same time as many of the women featured in the series.
They were willing as retired grandmothers to sit down with me, knowing that their grandkids might see this and say, this happened to me, and I'm doing this because I know this happened to her, and I know this happened to her, and no one's ever believed us. But if we're all willing to take this step and talk about this horrific past, people will believe us.
I was just wondering why we don't know if she or Joyce were sexually assaulted. I don't remember hearing anything about that in the autopsy or anything in the documentary.
They may have just avoided the topic. When the lieutenant described her upper body as being exposed, that is an indicator to me that there was sexual intent behind this. So I would not think that it didn't happen. I would think that it did happen. Plus the binding of Joyce may also be an indication that they wanted control over her for that purpose as well. But I just don't think that, we didn't actually see the autopsy reports. I think that they would have had that information in it, and we'll just have to wait to see if we can find those, get those reports before we can make a conclusion about it. But I do believe that at least with Sister Kathy's body, there is an indication, unfortunately, that there was sexual assault.
The question I had for you, because they found her 2 months later in the snow and seemed to be well preserved, but do you still think she was killed right after she was abducted, or is there a way that she was killed later?
There's no way that she wasn't killed that night. Her car was returned within hours of her going missing. She was definitely dead. There's no way that she was saved for a while. There's no indications at all that she was in captivity or that anything happened other than that she was disposed of almost immediately. That would be the highest likelihood behaviorally. Don't you agree, Laura?
I do. I think, when you think about the motive for this crime and, the fact that, yes, she was partially clothed, we can't rule out the sexual element. And the fact that it's not criminally sophisticated, is it someone trying to throw, people off what the crime was really about? That's a possibility too. But I think, this much more speaks to motive. And if that were her screaming, and if it's a man's voice and an explosion of anger, and the motive is to silence her, then getting her in the car and there were two significant blunt force trauma blows to her head, so that would make sense. And whoever this was would want to dispose of her as quickly as possible. Coming back in the car, that transfer, and then distancing themselves from what happened would be their primary concern at this point. It is interesting what was going on for her, a few days beforehand. And it's also interesting, that the police weren't called for a number of hours as well. But I think, we have to consider the motive as the primary thing here to understand what this is all about. But offenders do take the opportunity at times. And there's no reason, if you do have someone who is a sexual predator or engaged in that type of behaviour, that they do not take the opportunity to defile and violate, her and or Joyce as well, if we believe them to be linked.
Yeah, I think that if you look at the timeline, and basically I'll go through it really quickly here. Basically at 3 p.m., Sister Kathy returned to her apartment for the day. At 7, she left to go buy a gift at a shopping center. She went there. She bought dinner rolls at that shopping center as well, and then most likely drove back home, but never got actually into her apartment. At 8:30 p.m., there was a witness that said that she saw Sister Kathy sitting in her car. It looked like she was waiting. And then shortly after that is when the two girls said that they heard loud voices in the direction of her apartment or parking lot. At a certain point, probably somewhere around 10:30, Sister Russell, who was Sister Kathy's roommate and also teaching in a public school out of habit, she called Father Coob because she knew that Father Coob had a very close relationship with Sister Kathy. And he he basically arrived sometime in the 10:30 area, 10:30 or so. And then he said about an hour later, when they still hadn't heard from Kathy, they called the police. At 1:30, the police arrived, so that was around 2 hours later. And they took the complaint and so forth, but doesn't seem like they actually kicked into high gear at all at that point. And then at 4:30, Father Koop said that he was out for a walk and was walking around the complex and found Sister Kathy's car parked with sticks and swampy mess on the tires. So it was after the police were already called that the car was discovered. And I have to believe that it was sometime in between there that the offender actually bought the car back and then retrieved his own car. So had the police done what they should have done, which is immediately take down all the license plates in the area, start knocking on doors, looking for people, asking for people if they heard anything or saw anything. If they had done that right then I believe they would have had the license plate of the killer and they may have identified him right away. They also probably would have been around when he tried to drop off her car and they may have seen him in her vehicle. So they missed an amazing opportunity there, but, you know, we'll never get that back.
No, those golden hours that we've talked about before are just so critical. And I think, you know, when you hear Captain John Barnard talk about him being the youngest captain and, you know, just some of the key things that he said that, you know, well, people go missing every day. Well, not like this, they don't. And so there are cases and cases. Yeah. And he then, you know, just says, well, we had 200 murders a year, you know, sex offences and so many things going on. But these are standout cases, aren't they, Jim? And yeah. I was pretty angry when I was listening to him just really just say, yeah, excuse after excuse and saying, well, I had to trust my team to get the work done. I'm sorry, that's utter BS. You're there as a supervisor. You're there as a captain to supervise your team, to make sure that they are doing the things that you just described at the time where it's the golden hours of making sure that the investigation is proactive. Right. And then when he says, well, we didn't want to advertise it. Well, you bloody well should have advertised it because you've got to use the public and people who can come forward and tell you
and
what
warn,
they saw and what they heard.
And warn Joyce Malecki that there is danger out there. I mean, it's just outrageous. And, you know, he says he ran the investigation, but I say it wasn't even an investigation. He said, well, there are no signs of foul play. A nun who lives in this environment, who has never been missing before, who's not a teen that ran away seven times, is gone. That is a sign of foul play. Who did they interview immediately? Where did they search immediately? Why didn't they do more immediately? That is a major failure on the part of those police officers. And I just can't, well, it's why this case is cold. Otherwise, this case would have been solved if they had done, when they got on the site at 1:30 a.m., if they had done what they should have done, which is lock down that area, do a comprehensive search of that area, and do a neighborhood canvas asking everybody what they saw, what they heard, bothering people, yes, but also alerting people that there is a potential dead person, somebody who was abducted, whose body is going to be found 2 months later. They should have warned them. They could have warned them. And for him to say, rely on the fact that he had 200 murders, that isn't even one a day, and this is one of them. Yet he didn't give it any, like, real credibility.
Well, isn't her car a sign of foul play?
All of it is screaming out, but he just turns around and just blows all of this off so casually and nonchalantly. And yet a young woman was abducted and killed, and he then very clearly articulates there was no proactive investigation.
Right, and you see that a lot in this documentary series, a lot. And it is the major contention that I have with what they did and what they didn't do. The entire justice system failed these women, failed all the victims in this case, and it just really pisses me off.
Well, as Jim was just saying, it seems like law enforcement definitely failed these women. But there are two women who did not fail them, and those are Kathy Cesnik's former students, Gemma Hoskins and Abby Schaub. And I got to tell you, when I saw these women, my heart just leaped. I mean, there was something about them that just they just seem so incredible, so tough, so doggedly determined, and so different. Where you have Gemma, she's described as a bulldog of a woman. I want to be this woman when I grow up. She has like bright red hair, and she's just balls out and will talk to anybody and has her own way. I love how she kind of looks at the camera sometimes, like, "Oi, I don't believe a thing this guy's saying." And then on the opposite end, there's this sweet Mary and the librarian type of woman, Abby Schaub, who's just the most grandmotherly, soft, sweet, bespeckled person. And these two women...
You're such a casting agent, by the way.
I can't help it. But they're just such incredible spirits and people who really brought this cold case and made it hot. What did you think of them?
I thought they were amazing. I thought they were the kind of women and the kind of friends, more importantly, that don't want to let their friend Sister Kathy down. They were so touched by her. They were so enamored of her kindness and her compassion that they didn't want to let her just suffer out there without finding justice.
They're definitely a great team. I mean, their dogged determination, but just also, you know, Gemma, like, loving being the out and about person. As you said, Lisa, will talk to anybody, will chase things down, incredibly tenacious. And then Abby wants to be in the background doing all the kind of, you know, Garcia-type role from Criminal Minds of putting everything together, creating systems, researching. And, you know, that's the perfect team. You don't want two people who want to do exactly the same thing. You know, so as a female duo, incredible. And just their compassion and their kindness and the way that they interacted with the other women, obviously, you know, was something that unique that you see. Is they're real advocates, and they wanted the truth, the search for justice. They were 100% invested because they wanted their teacher to have justice finally and to get this resolved. And I have no doubt, you know, this is an incredibly difficult journey that they've been on. And just to say, I know we're going to get to it, but it's in deep contrast to the character that's called Deep Throat that comes up later, who was a detective who wanted total anonymity, you know. And these are women who are gutsy and ballsy and taking on not just, you know, a murder case, but the whole system effectively.
Right. And, you know, the Gemma and Abby start this website or Facebook page, Justice for Kathy and for Joyce, because they figure, well, you know, while we're researching this case, we may as well try to solve Joyce's murder too, because nobody else was helping that family, and they really got let down. There's somebody at the very end that comes into the story who could absolutely blow the whole case wide open and tell us exactly what happened.
Because this witness actually said she saw Sister Kathy's body out at that dump site in that rural area. And that is something that obviously creates a whole new twist.
Right. Before the police found the body, before anything else, that she saw it first and she knew exactly why Sister Kathy had been murdered.
So we're going to get into that in the next episode, where they leave it on a cliffhanger as to who this person is. And this person then comes forward and puts a very different light on everything that's happened.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. And we will be continuing this series of podcasts covering the Netflix documentary, The Keepers.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotion and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And one last thing is, please tell all your friends, family, and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline, free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214 946 4357 or go on their website www.genesisshelter.org or the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.